From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Hello, this is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This week we have the concluding part of Professor Jack Copeland's talk which he gave at this year's Turing Education Day. In this part he concentrates on the Turing test and Colossus.
He moved on to publish a paper in 1950, this famous paper of Turing's that he called Computing, Machinery and Intelligence. And in it he described what we all today call the Turing test, but he called the imitation game. I guess everyone knows nowadays what the Turing test is. You have three participants. There's the judge, and then there's another human player, and then there's the computer that's under test. And the judge, just by chatting to the other two players, so kind of the equivalent of like texting them or emailing them or something, you're chatting to them by email. On the basis of the conversation that the judge has, they have to try and say which is the computer and which is the human. Turing said the computer can use any tricks it likes in order to evade identification. So the computer can lie, it can give the wrong answer to questions like, you know, please multiply these two huge numbers together. If you say to it, are you the computer, it's allowed to say, no, I'm the human being, and so on and so forth. If the computer manages to evade identification, if the judge can't do better than the guessing rate of 50% at telling which is which, then the computer is said to have passed the Turing test. What exactly is supposed to follow if a computer passes the Turing test? Well, Turing said that the question, can machines think, isn't the same as the question, can a computer pass the Turing test? But he says those questions are near enough for our purposes. So Turing is advancing this as a test for near enough whether computers can think. Turing's come in for a bit of criticism recently because he's claimed to have predicted that the Turing test would be passed at the turn of the last century. So according to Turing, the Turing test is going to be passed in 2000. That's what people say Turing said. And there's been some criticism of Turing in the media and even in the introduction to Sarah Turing's biography of her son, which has been republished. There's a second edition that came out a few weeks ago. And there's an introduction to that book in which it's explained that, well, Turing was just too optimistic. Turing thought that the Turing test would be passed by the year 2000, but that's just because Turing underestimated the complexity of the problem, according to the person who wrote that preface. But none of that's true. Turing didn't predict that the Turing test would be passed at the end of last century. Here's his actual prediction. And this was in a conversation with his friend and colleague, co-breaker Max Newman. And it was actually broadcast on BBC Radio back in 1952. So Newman says, I should like to be there when your match between a man and a machine takes place, and perhaps to try my hand at making up some of the questions. But that will be a long time from now, if the machine is to stand any chance with no questions barred. And Turing cheerfully says, oh yes, at least 100 years, I should say. So that prediction's got at least another 40 years to run. Notice he doesn't say in exactly 100 years. He says at least 100 years, so 100 years or more. So I think this shows that, you know, no way did Turing underestimate the complexity of the problem of writing a program to pass the Turing test. He knew it was one of the hardest possible challenges to face programmers. Max Newman worked about 100 yards from this building. He was originally a lecturer at Cambridge. He taught Turing. He was a few years Turing's senior, so Newman was a lecturer when Turing was a student. By Newman's own account, it was Newman himself, in some lectures on foundations of mathematics, who gave Turing the ideas that set him off on the research that led ultimately to his great invention, the universal Turing machine. So Newman was a key player from the start. And in 1942, Newman left Cambridge and came here. He'd stayed on lecturing at Cambridge for a few years after Turing left. But in 1942, Newman came here in order to attack, along with Turing, the new problem of Tunney. which is the topic of Jerry Roberts's lecture. So I won't say much about it, but I'll just give you a few brief details. The Tunny machine was the new German cipher machine. It had only just been intercepted by the British by the time Newman arrived at Bletchley Park. It was the kind of the successor to Enigma. It was much more sophisticated than Enigma. So it was a wheeled machine, more wheels than with Enigma. There's 12 of them, so I guess that's a kind of crude measure of the increased complexity of the Tunny machine compared to Enigma. Enigma was slow and clumsy. It involved three operators at each end of the link to encipher and send the message, and then three at the other end to decrypt the message. And you had to use Morse code to broadcast the encrypted message from one end of the link to the other. Tunny was a much slicker machine. It just required one operator at each end of the link. It didn't use Morse code. The output of the Tunny machine, which was encrypted binary teleprint code, just went directly to air. They didn't need to use Morse code. And the whole system was so sophisticated, automated to such a degree, that the operators at each end of the link, they never even got to see the encrypted form of the message. As far as they were concerned, it was just plain German in, plain German out. They never even saw the ciphertext. The 12 wheels divide into three groups, two groups of five, which here at Bletchley they call the Psi wheels and the Chi wheels, and then two other wheels in the middle, the motor wheels. The function of the motor wheels was just to cause other wheels to move, so they're kind of boring. We don't need to think about them anymore. The heart of the encryption process was the Chi wheels and the Psi wheels. The Tunny machine essentially did its work by enciphering the message twice. So the operator would type the message in plain German at the teleprinter keyboard here, and then the Chi wheels would add one layer of encryption, and the Psi wheels would add a second layer of encryption, and then the encrypted binary teleprint code would go to air. The logical structure of the Tunny machine was worked out by one of the great code breakers here, Bill Tutt, and moreover, he was able to work out those details without ever having seen a Tunny machine. As I've explained, Enigma machines were captured. They had them here. They could look at them to figure out the fine details of how they worked. No Tunny machine was captured until the final days of the war. So Bill Tutt didn't have an actual machine to look at. He had to use pure thought. And miraculously, pure thought was enough to enable Tutt to deduce the logical structure of the Tunny machine. And moreover, he performed that amazing feat on the basis of just two messages. Two scungy messages was enough for Tutt to reverse engineer the Tunny machine. And so that was kind of the first step of the process. They now knew how the machine worked, but now there was that next, second, huge step of finding a method for breaking the daily message traffic. Because just having an Enigma machine in front of you, knowing how it works, that's not going to enable you to break the daily messages. You need a method that's going to crack the messages for you. And that's where Turing came in. It was Turing who made that next great step. Turing invented the first systematic method for breaking into the daily Tunny traffic. In the laconic jargon that they used here, they called it simply Turingery. Jerry Roberts and his colleagues worked in what was called the testery, a section run by Ralph Tester, hence the name. In the testery, they applied Turingery in order to break the daily Tunny traffic. Thanks to Turingery, the codebreakers were able pretty much to listen in to what Hitler and his generals were saying to each other over breakfast. Because Tunny, quite unlike Enigma, carried only the highest grade of cipher traffic. Messages between Hitler and the army chiefs in Berlin and the generals at the front lines right around the various theatres of war. So there was this giant network of Tunny radio connections right across Europe and down to North Africa. It was kind of a harbinger of today's mobile phone networks. So Hitler was chatting, you know, to the generals at the Russian front, and they were sending back what their tactics were going to be. We're going to do a pincer movement or whatever, and these are the numbers of troops that we've got, and this is how we think the Russians are going to respond, and so on. Bletchley was listening in to all this fine detail. Tunny was Hitler's BlackBerry, and Turing had hacked into the system. But Turingery was a hand method. It wasn't applied initially by machine. It was applied by people working with sheets of paper. Jerry will tell you all about this later on, what he did himself. It was rather like breaking crosswords using sheets of paper. And for the first 8 months of the attack on Tunney, all that the codebreakers had was Turingery, this pencil and paper method. It worked, but so many Tunney messages were being generated that they needed a machine to help them. And it would need to be a much faster machine than Turing's bomb, simply because the Tunney machine was so much more complicated. That's where the great electronic engineer Tommy Flowers entered the story. Flowers had worked with electronic valves, using them as digital switches, during the 1930s, before the war, and so he knew inside out how these things worked. Flowers was a telephone engineer, and he kind of lived to build giant machines out of electronic valves. That was his passion. So when he came to Bletchley Park, he turned out to be the right man in the right place at the right time. He was introduced to the Tunney problem, and he could see immediately what they needed. And he offered to build them a machine, a high-speed digital computing machine, consisting of 2,000 electronic valves for cracking Tunney messages. So the bigwigs at Bletchley Park, they took advice about Flowers' suggestion. They consulted other electrical engineers. And these other experts said, don't touch it with a barge pole. This machine that this guy from the post office is recommending that you build, it will never work. Because the story at the time was that you couldn't use electronic valves in large numbers. And 2,000 is a very large number. Flowers was proposing to use a very large number of electronic valves. You could use a dozen in a radio set, you could use a couple of dozen, maybe 3 dozen. But the idea was, amongst engineers at the time, that valves were just too flaky to be used in numbers larger than that. Electronic valves contain a hot glowing filament, which is the source of the electron beam, which is the only moving part of the valve. That's why it's enabled to do its switching so fast. But that hot glowing filament was fragile. And so the idea was that if you use large numbers of valves, it would only be a few minutes before another one blew. And so the machine would be out of operation more than it was in operation. It just wasn't a practical proposition because valves weren't reliable enough in large numbers. But Flowers knew better. Flowers had discovered, as a result of his own experimental research, that it's the switching of valves on and off that makes them so fragile. He knew that as long as you turned the equipment on and then just left it on, let it run, then valves were perfectly reliable. And so there was just no obstacle to using them in large numbers. But Bletchley Park said thanks but no thanks to Flowers. So Flowers just went back to his laboratory in North London and quietly got on with building the all-electronic machine that he knew the codebreakers needed. And one day in January 1944, some of Flowers' lads turned up at Bletchley Park with the world's first large-scale electronic computer on the back of a lorry. It's an amazing story, I think. Colossus was a very apt name. It weighed about a ton and it was the size of a large room. You can see two of Colossus's operators, two of the world's first computer operators, Dorothy Dubuisson standing on the left and a local Bletchley girl, Elsie Booker, on the right. They called them girls in those days. I shouldn't really use the term, but that's what they called them. You can see the punched paper tape too on these aluminium wheels. The message to be deciphered has been punched onto the tape in teleprint code, and the tape is being fed into the machine for the message to be analysed. Once Colossus was here and working, it gave the Allies an absolutely unrivaled picture of the German counter-preparations for the D-Day invasion. D-Day was, of course, in the summer of 1944. Colossus 1 was working from February 1944, few weeks after Flowers delivered it. So by reading Tunney messages, Jerry Roberts and his colleagues enabled the intelligence people here to build up this very detailed picture of where the German forces were positioned and what they were expecting the British to do and where they were expecting the British attack to come and so on. And the intelligence provided by Colossus had a crucial impact on the timing of the D-Day landings, as I think Jerry is going to explain to you later on. And also Turing's bombs and the Enigma intelligence that they provided also had a crucial effect on the timings of the D-Day landings. Because It was Turing and Turing's bombs, as I've explained, that made it possible to defeat the U-boats in the North Atlantic. It was the Navy that sank the U-boats, of course, but it was intelligence provided by Hut 8 here that helped the Navy in that task, that made it possible to defeat the U-boats so quickly. If the Navy hadn't been able to defeat the North Atlantic U-boats, then it would have been impossible to build up the vast numbers of men and munitions and transport, etc., etc., in the south of England that they needed to mount the D-Day invasion. If the U-boats had still been sinking the convoys, it would have been later that the D-Day invasion occurred. The Navy would first of all have had to hunt down the U-boats without the help of the intelligence from Naval Enigma. That would have taken longer, and so inevitably the D-Day invasion would have been later. How much later? We don't know. No one can say. You can only guess. These are counterfactuals, and counterfactuals are, you know, fishy kind of things. But there would certainly have been a delay. 6 months, a year, who knows? And Hitler would have used that delay in order to fortify Europe even more. The fortifications along the Channel coast would have been made even more formidable. Even more troops would have been moved into the French coastal area from the Eastern Front. He'd already had time to pull huge panzer divisions from the Eastern Front and position them ready to fight the invading forces. With more time, he'd have been able to bring in even more panzer divisions. And also, he would no doubt have fortified the Rhine as well as the French coast. So with more time to prepare, things would presumably have gone quite differently. It actually took the Allies a year to fight their way from the French coast to Berlin, with greater preparation time on the German side. Who knows how much longer that might have taken? Maybe twice as long. Who knows? So, at the crudest of estimates, a conservative estimate, about 7 million lives were being lost each year during the war as a direct result of the fighting. So, you can do the maths. If the war had extended for another year, 7 million lives, 2 years, 14 million lives, and so on. So, huge numbers of lives. And we've got Alan Turing as one of the key players in this process. Of course, you can't say that if it hadn't been for what Turing and his colleagues here did, that the war would have gone on for another year or another 2 years. I know people do say this. Some very distinguished historians have said this. But you can't really claim that, that the war would have gone on for another couple of years if it hadn't been for what they did at Bletchley Park. Because if you talk about the war having gone on for an additional 2 years, you're sort of talking about a parallel universe to this one in which events ran slightly differently. Turing didn't break U-boat Enigma at the time he did, and so the war went on longer in this parallel universe. But in that parallel universe, some other counterfactual event might have happened that caused the war to stop exactly in May 1945, when it did actually stop. For example, God help us, the Allies might have dropped an atomic device on Berlin. And as a result of that, in this counterfactual parallel world, the war did stop at exactly the time when it actually stopped. So you can't say that if it hadn't been for Bletchley Park, the war would have gone on for another 2 years. But you can look at those enormous numbers, 7 million lives, 14 million lives, 21 million lives. The sheer size of these numbers conveys a sense of the magnitude of the role played by the codebreakers here.
The next Bletchley Park podcast will be out on the 10th of October. But in the meantime, why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we're at @BParkPodcast, or subscribe on iTunes. Once again, we must thank the Alan Turing Year and all the speakers involved for these recordings. And of course, Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.